have an AA meeting. My name is Lisa, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. So I'm really excited to introduce the speaker tonight. I really like Katie. I met Katie here at NABA several years ago. Seems like a different lifetime. And I have just watched God in this program just really work on you and blossom you, and you're just awesome. So anyway, I give you Katie H.
Thanks so much, sweetie. I appreciate that. Hey, everybody. My name's Katie. I'm an alcoholic. Hey. Can y'all hear me okay? Yeah. All right, I'm going to give you first a disclosure. I'm sitting down, which I feel I have to ask y'all to forgive me, but I had foot surgery in January, and so it just really hurts to stand up. So that's the only reason I'm not standing. Thank you. So I appreciate you asking me, Lisa. I always love coming into NABA. There's such good old friends here and new faces that I see, but it's just so comforting to come somewhere where people know your name and you're welcomed. I don't know about y'all, but I was not welcome at a lot of places I used to frequent when I was drinking, and it's nice to come here I've been coming here about 20 years, and I'm always welcome, and it's special, and the place looks nice, and the friendly faces are so welcoming to me, and I'm just so glad to be here tonight. My sobriety date is July 12th, 2009, and I have a sponsor, and I have a home group, which is the Fifth Tradition Group, and I sponsor some women, and they are probably the biggest joy in my life right now. They help me so much. It's amazing how much sponsees help the sponsor. So don't ever worry if they tell you to call you, not bothering them. You're helping them stay sober. So I will do exactly what Dear Red, which is tell y'all what I was like, what happened to me, and what I'm like now, and hopefully show you how I developed a relationship with a higher power that keeps me sober today. So I'm going to do that to the best of my ability. So I got sober. I was born not sober yet. I was born about 2 or 3 miles from here. I grew up in this area. I went to Lakeside High School and Oak Grove Elementary School, and I was the third and last child of my two parents who provided for me and gave me opportunities, and they loved me very, very much. And I say that because I think that we can become alcoholic no matter where we come from or what we had or didn't have or anything like that. So my dad is an alcoholic. He's passed now, but I did grow up in an alcoholic home, and my sister and brother were older than me, and I remember from a very young age, I always just wanted to be out of the house. I played sports very alcoholically. It was, if I wasn't at, ballet, tap toe, or jazz, I was at softball or gymnastics or diving or swimming or, just anything. Just constantly gone and playing in the neighborhood, always with a bunch of guys playing sports. And that, is, I guess, how I spent my time. I wasn't a very studious child. I didn't make very good grades. The first thing that was kind of impactful, I remember about 7th grade, I had a couple of beers with some friends of mine, and nothing really happened. Like some people say, they knew from the very first time. That was not my experience. I had a few beers with the neighborhood friends, and it may have been because of something else that happened that same year, which I do believe is important enough to share, and that is that my older sister, she was probably like, freshman or sophomore in college, and she was she was doing some kind of hard drugs. I don't know. I think it's LSD is what we were told. And she got picked up, you know, doing some crazy stuff. From what I understand, she was walking down the highway with a head of lettuce on her head. And she got picked up and brought home to my house. And my parents were screaming. And I remember hearing it from upstairs. And I was like, what is going on down there? And I go down there and there's paraphernalia everywhere. And I was asking my brother what all of it was. And you know how you have all the stuff to do all the things with. And my brother was like, I think Suzanne got busted. And so I was like, I remember thinking, I will never do that. I can't believe that this caused my parents so much grief. And, you know, and I just want, you know, I can't just go back to college. You know, this is just troublesome. And I remember thinking, I'll never do that. And, you know, then, so, you know, some, you know, we had to go, my parents were naive to this kind of thing. And so instead of like doing a 30-day treatment program, instead they put her in West Paces Ferry Mental Institution. And we were all brought up there as a family to see that and deal with that. And it was heartbreaking and it was difficult. And I was in like seventh grade. And I remember thinking, you know, I'm never going to do that. You know, I mean, why would anybody do that to cause as much harm in the family? And then, you know, years passed and my brother was older and, you know, my sister got a DUI and my brother got a couple DUIs, rolled a car and, you know, just different things like that. And he was drinking cough medicine and doing all kinds of crazy stuff that I guess, you know, people who are alcoholic do, like myself. And so I remember again thinking, I am never going to be that person. You know, I was kind of the good kid, I guess you could say. And after my sister and my after my brother left, I was only in like eighth grade, and things were calm at the house and everything was good. And my dad's drinking escalated and I started seeing a lot of that. But I was just like, he went to bed early and I just hung with my mom. And you know, I was like the cheerleader and, you know, I was just trying to, I guess I thought if I just, I was on the gymnastics team and I cheered and I just thought, you know, life was very, very good. I didn't have really any problems in high school. I started living a little bit of a double life that Bill talks about because I had some cousins that were a couple years older than me and they would come in town and, you know, they, and way back then you could just, I mean, they fly from Chicago to Atlanta two or three times a year and they always had pot in their suitcases and we all, you know, nobody ever thought anything of it. And we'd all get stoned and we'd drink and, you know, summers and Christmases. And then I'd go back and act like the good kid at school. And I never had any consequences from alcohol in high school, really. I don't remember my graduation, so I'm sure I got drunk a few times. But, you know, nothing as bad as it gets. And so I went on to college. I went to the University of Georgia. And I didn't make any sports there, obviously, because it would be very hard. And so I kind of just was like just a bozo on the bus, I guess. I wasn't special at all. And I was in remedial studies because I barely got in. And you know, I stayed in the dorms with all the athletes because they put special studies people who are people that don't have the grades to get into college in the same dorms as the athletes. So it was just right in my face. You know, this is where you could be if you're really a good athlete. But instead, you're here and you do have to pay and you don't even get credit for your classes. So I was like, God, I'm a loser. And so I joined this sorority and I was in there and I started noticing that my drinking was very different from all the rest of the girls in the sorority, and it stood out like a sore thumb. I mean, I was drinking heavily, and I ended up getting my first DUI, and so talk about a double life. I mean, I'm living in my sorority house. I get a DUI, immediately started jumping into the solution to figure it out. Didn't want the parents to know, to upset them and have them fight. So I ended up getting a job at this topless bar up the street in Athens, and I thought I'm not actually that bad because I'm just a waitress, so I'm not topless. And of course I went ahead and did my first horrible thing there that, you know, well, I won't say that y'all do, but I do. And that's like, so I worked a few nights at this topless bar. I'm taking like a taxi to and from A.O. Pie House. I'm living in A.O. Pie House and I'm trying to raise money real quickly for this DUI I have. And a man says, hey, you know, I'll give you $100 if you do this, that, and the other. And I thought, that's a hell of a lot better than taking a taxi up here for three more nights. So I said, sure thing. And so, you know, I started doing stuff like that I never would have done. And that was like, because I was intoxicated, the only reason I would have done something like that. So I ended up going to court and told him I was indigent. And the court said, you know, he fined me guilty, found me guilty, and told him I owed him like $300. And that was the fine. It was like 1984, 85. So I had all these ones in this Crown Royal bag, and this is just how belligerent I was and how narcissistic I was and everything. And he said, you know, the court finds you guilty. And I was like, how do you know? You didn't even ask him. And he was like, ma'am, I am the court. And he, like, you know, did his thing. And I threw the Crown Royal bag up there, and there was 300 ones in it. And, you know, and I just thought I was all that in a bag of chips. And, you know, I walked out of there and learned no lesson whatsoever. And I'll spare you the details of that night. But when I got the DUI, first off, I didn't have a car, and I still managed to get a DUI. And when I got the DUI, I was tripping also, which is exactly what my sister had done. I was tripping. And so I'm in the precinct going, you know, why is my name up there three times? And the cop's like, you know, it's not up there, you know, it's hallucinating. And I had this accident on my skateboard from coming down a real steep hill. So I had this bruised face, my chin was like way over here, and my mugshot was pretty ridiculous. And, you know, it's like I learned absolutely nothing. I mean, I looked just so horrible. I got out, my friends were waiting, and we started drinking, and I woke up, went to class the next day, and I thought nothing of it. Nobody knows, didn't happen. Continued on drinking, got introduced to some other drugs while I was in college. I remember thinking I would never do those kind of things, and I started doing exactly that. I failed out of Georgia, and I thought, oh, I'll just move to Atlanta and move in with a drug dealer, and I'll go to Georgia State, take this one class, because that was my first huge consequence. Well, I guess the DUI was my first consequence, but I had that. So I moved in, couldn't pass the class at Georgia State after two or three times taking that one class, failed that, so they kicked me out. They're like, well, you're not welcome here either. So I never did go back and graduate college, and I only had one class left. But I did offer my parents to pay them back money once I was able to afford that, and they both said, you know, they said I did not have to. They didn't want me to. I mean, I ended up paying for my father, who was alcoholic, for the last 3 years of his life, and that was very, 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 very expensive. So I guess I paid him back. But, you know, and I take care of my mom now, so I do it in different ways. But anyway, so I ended up, I drank really heavily until I was in 1992. I ended up getting two DUIs back to back within 20 days. And I say all this stuff. I like drunkologues. Some people don't really like them, but I like to talk a little bit about them because I learned when I came in here that our disease center's in our mind, and I didn't get that at all. I thought that makes no sense at all, but it's because, you know, even after you dry up, whether I ended up going to a women's prison for 9 days when I got the back-to-back DUIs, and when I came out of there, I wasn't physically addicted to alcohol, yet I couldn't wait to drink again because I had the mental obsession to drink, and that's the difference between a regular alcoholic, where we're from a distinct entity of people. I believe that I'm beyond anything human can help me. It has to be a higher power. And so I ended up getting a DUI when I was playing on I was playing on five softball teams at the old softball park over there in Stone Mountain. Again, ridiculous. And we won, and so I started drinking, and I was headed to back streets, and 10 o'clock at night, and I had a girl with me in the car, and I got pulled over, and she took her backpack and ran, and I go to jail. And that was my second DUI, but the first in 20 days. And so then about, you know, I immediately am like, okay, what am I going to do? And so I get this job at the sign company, and then I get a job at Circuit City, and I get a job at Lapeed Breakfast. And I'm working these three jobs because I got to raise this money because I know I'm going to jail. And, like, you know, I'm sitting there going, I'm never going to drink again, you know. Like, you know, we do sometimes. You know, I'm not going to drink again. And, like, 3 or 4 days go by, and then I start saying, well, I'll just drink at home. I mean, that's a little bit ridiculous. So you're never going to drink again. Just drink at home, you know. And so maybe a week goes by, and so now I remember the date. It was November 4th, 1992, because it was when Clinton was elected. And 20 days later was Thanksgiving Eve, and I spent both nights in jail because. So here I am, November 24th, 20 days later. I decide that I can go out to a bar on Chester Bridge, but I only bring $3 with me because it's quarter beer night, and I can't possibly get drunk on that. So me and my little DUI yellow piece of paper go out for the evening, and I'm just sure that I'm not going to drink a lot because I started doing the odds. One thing I learned at Georgia was math, and I started saying, you know, there's what are the odds that I'm going to get pulled over again? I mean, you know, who does that? You know, normal people that get a DUI say they never drink again. But I'm like, what are the odds? I'm like, the odds are not, you know, that. By the way, the first DUI I was going back street, so I was near Chester Bridge. So I end up going out, drinking. I did not drink that much. I left after, I don't know, probably 8 or 9 cups of beer. But I was pretty sober-minded. And I'm driving home and speeding and singing along because it's, you know, Christmas music on, Thanksgiving Eve, and I'm speeding. And I get pulled over, and I'm like, oh, my God, you got to be kidding. And I start trying to talk the cop out of it with all kinds of ways. Y'all can use your imagination, you know. Please don't give me a DUI. And I have to hand him a DUI, you know, and he makes me do a couple of tests, and I fail. And so I go, and I remember it was the first time someone said, have you ever heard of Alcoholics Anonymous? I'm like, dude, just give me, just arrest me, put me, you know, just whatever. Let's get this over with. I didn't want to hear anything about recovery. I told them, you know, just shut up. You're a stupid rookie cop. You know, I'm not drunk. You know, you should not do this. But I avoided, I think I denied the breathalyzer, so they did a blood test. And I was low. I was only like 0.12, which is like a third of what I was 2 weeks prior. So I thought I was doing better. And so I go to jail, and now I'm in Atlanta City Detention. The first time I was there was like all these women there, and there were roaches on the floor, and they were all sleeping on the floor, and there was a good bit of them may have been prostitutes or something. So they were just kind of sleeping it off, and I was like in the cell going, I'm never drinking again. And now here I am going back to the same place. Meanwhile, I told them I was indigent again, so I had got on my own recognizance on November 4th. Well, now I can't be indigent because I got to get somebody to get me out of jail. So I'm getting fingerprinted. My car gets towed to the same place. It was just an absolute disaster. And now I go and they put me in a cell all by myself, and I am absolutely freezing because I probably wore very little clothing out to drink that night. And I'm sitting in a big old cell by myself, freezing. And I'm like, how did you end up like this? This is terrible. And I'm screaming and no one's letting me out. So I get out about 3 o'clock on Thanksgiving. I called my brother and my cousin. They came and got me. I had to go, and I had to deal with my mother on Thanksgiving, and they lied and said it was them. And I mean, I smelled and I looked horrible. And again, if mom and them don't know, and I don't upset anybody, nobody knows. And so I ended up going to court, and I got 20 days, but I only did 9 days in a women's prison called Key Road Women's Prison, which is, you know, Luda shaking her head, she's been there. And men's prison was right across the way, and I actually had a good time in there. I try to make the best of anything. So I actually did have a very good time in there. I made some friends, and I remember a couple of things I remember that was funny was I went into the bathroom and in the middle of the night I was like changing out my contacts, and a couple of the girls were like, man, give me some of that. I'm like, these are contacts. These are for my vision. This ain't nothing for you. And I'm like, what are y'all doing? And I look in the bathroom and they're standing. They got 1 foot on the toilet, 1 foot on the wall, and the men are looking in the little crevice and throwing them quarters because they can see, you know. I'm like, oh, Lord. I was like, no, don't do that. You know, I brought in lots of money. I'll give you the money. Don't do that for a quarter, you know. At least do it for $100 like I do. You know, and so I'm just like, oh, Lord. And then it leaked in there a lot. And I remember I slept with those nasty old woolen blankets that you have, and all the lights would go out. And it was like one time it was about we ate at 4, 12, and 4, and so the wardens or whatever they called us female, and they said, look, if there's no problems, we'll leave y'all alone from 4 o'clock on. So one of the things I did is I organized a dance contest in there, which was hilarious. We had the best time. I mean, we had a really good time. So of course I had to be the controller of all this. So I had a lot of the people that didn't want to participate. They were the judges. I mean, they were the audience. Sorry, all the people that didn't want to participate, they were the audience. And we had different outfits. I could deal with some like shorts. There were sweatpants. There were shirts. And so I used to work at Hooters, so I knew you could tie your shirt up in the back to make it real short and tied up. So anyway, a lot of the lesbians in there, they're like, "We'll judge." They're like, "Man, let us judge." And so I'm like, "Fine." And so there was a girl that I knew that had weekends. I knew her from the bar scene, and she came in on the weekends. So I said, she brought her Walkman. We used to have Walkmans way back then. She had her Walkman on. So I said, "This is what we're going to do." I was like, "The dance." Or the prisoner, whatever you want to call it, is going to come in with the Walkman, and nobody can hear the music except for a little bit outside the buds, but we'll all judge. And we all laughed so damn hard, and the women wore different clothing. Some of them wore short shorts, some of them tied their shirts, some of them didn't, and we had judges and the audience, you know, based on their clapping, and we had so much fun. I mean, we had the best time, and they were all like, you know, we'll see you on the outside, and all this stuff, and we played marbles for money, and, you know, jacks, and all that stuff, and, you know, and they taught me how to roll my hair with tampons, and, you know, it was pretty fun. I mean, I made the absolute best of, well, they were unused tampons, let me clarify. So, sorry guys, I'm bad, aren't I? Good Lord. But what did they say? You know, we hope none of these stories are in bad taste. I think I just failed that test. So anyway, I did that, and I got out, and my license was suspended. And, you know, I kept driving around my license, and I thought none of this really applies. And, you know, I was doing cocaine, and I was lost a bunch of weight, and my life was, I was like, let's see, this was in 92. So I got sober the first time in 95. So I drank and used for another 3 years, even after I had back-to-back DUIs, spent that time. I can't tell you countless times I woke up and I didn't know what I did or what I said or where this person came from. Or one time I lost my car. I looked outside. Many times I was like, oh, thank God my car's there. And other times I was like, where did I leave that son of a bitch? You know, where is it? And, you know, it was just over and over and over. And so I had gotten this job at a sign company, which I'm still out. I'll be 30 years in August. But I'd gotten this job. Remember when I got the DUIs, I got a job at a sign company, and then La Peep, and then Circuit City. And so I kept drinking. And so 1995, I remember I had lost, like, you know, everything. I had lost my job, but I'd lost everything else. I mean, my family was worried sick about me. I weighed about 98 pounds. Nobody wanted to be around me. I literally could not pay you to hang with me. I was like, anybody, girl, boy, old, young, don't care. Even, you know, I'd beg somebody young to hang with me. Anyway, I was a mess. So I came in here the first time. I was 27, and it was 1995. And I thought that I had arrived, like Bill W. talks about. And I came in here. I came into Napa. I came into Biscayne, various rooms around here. And I got sober for 8 years, and my life got really, really good. Because if you take away alcohol from someone, really, probably any of us, we don't do some of the same horrible things. I no longer insulted people. Believe it or not, I never got arrested. As soon as I quit drinking and doing drugs, I was never arrested again. It was amazing. And, you know, my family got off my back. I started excelling at the sign company. I was in sales. I wasn't drinking because I was losing jobs and drinking because I was winning jobs. I was just like on this. I started, you know, my job became my sport, my alcoholic sport, that I started pounding the pavements, and I had to be number one in sales. And so my sales numbers went high, and so I ended up buying all the stuff we buy, you know, the house, the cars, got the fancy cars, the house, and, you know, just, I thought I had arrived. I totally can relate to Bill when I thought that, and I always point that out when I'm reading it about I, because I remember coming in all these rooms, and yes, I would talk and be funny and everything like that, but I can tell you I wasn't spiritually fit, and I was not to stay sober, as one would imagine, and I was in judgment of others, and I was not content or, you know, peaceful, and I certainly couldn't handle the things that God would have thrown my way as, you know, as I got sober the second time. But I was, you know, I did get a lot better because I was a mess when I drank. I mean, you know, I've skipped a ton, but I mean, I went to rehabs and treatments and detox and, you know, all this stuff. And so I got sober for 8 years, and around 35 years old, I thought, you know, again, you know, I mean, I had this fellowship. You know, the fellowship will help you stay sober. It needs to be more than that. That's why we have a triangle of three things, but the fellowship is important. And I was living on the fellowship because I didn't have a sponsor, and, you know, I had one in name, and I'd come in and share, and the amount of people that laughed and, you know, made me feel better about myself, and I just went home and didn't drink. And so about 35 years old, I had no power against the first drink at all, no defense at all. And one day I thought, you know, I've made way too much stuff with this alcoholism. How in the hell could you be an alcoholic at 27 years old? You got this house, it's nice, you got a Benz, you got, you know, whatever I had, you know. And I was just like, I cannot possibly be alcoholic, this is stupid. And so I drank, and no thought about it at all, other than, you know, a lot of my friends, because of fellowship, a lot of them had split. There were couples, a lot of them split up. My brother drank again. You know, people moved away. I started thinking, you know, less than of people. I started separating myself. I was either better than you or worse than you. And I just thought alcoholics, and I just started coming in the rooms and judging people. If you're doing that, be careful, because I was like, you know, I don't know what these losers have anyway. Look at them. And, of course, I was like 35, so I'd look at someone old like me now, and I'd be like, you know, God, they're sitting on a Monday night in an AA meeting. What a loser. I mean, I was just so full of judgment and self. And so I went out and I drank. And the first night, I just had a few and went home. My cousin lived with me. He didn't notice anything. I thought, see, not an alcoholic. And within 2 or 3 weeks, I was blacking out. I mean, blacking out. And it was exactly like they say, you know, nothing's worse than knowing that you are alcoholic and being in Alcoholics Anonymous and then drinking again. So I had all that remorse. I didn't want to come in and admit it. I kept drinking and thinking I could do it differently, and that, you know, and for a while I kept it away from my folks, and then I started, you know, I got, you know, life just got really, really bad and out of hand. And so, of course, what happens? I get another DUI. So here comes DUI number four. By this time, I'm the sales manager. I've been there decades, at least 20, and I don't know how long I've been there, but a long time. And you know, didn't tell them about the DUI at first, started trying to figure everything out. I ended up passing out. I started drinking in the morning. It got so bad, so I passed out a couple times at work. You know, they found me in my office one time asleep on my day timer, and they had to, you know, pick the lock and come in. I was like drooling all over my day timer. They knew I used to be an Alcoholics Anonymous, so they took me to detox, and then I went to, and then it happened again. They called my mother. She had to come in like on a cane into my work, because there I was at 10 o'clock in the morning, drunk again. I mean, it was just, you know, you understand, I was powerless. I mean, there was, you know, so many mornings and nights that I said, please, God, you know, just get me through the day today, and there's no way I'll drink again. And then by 3 or 4, I convinced myself that I changed my mind. I wasn't sitting there going, I'm powerless. I was like, I just changed my mind. I mean, I've already got alcohol at the house. If I don't stop and get a little bit before I go home, I'm going to run out, and I'll go back out again, and I already have 4 DUIs, and I see all this justification. You know, I was like, I'm going to, you know, and I mean, I was on abuse. I tried everything. So I drank for 6 to 8 more years, and I was in and out of this room and Biscayne and all the rooms, and I was just like, you know, everybody's judging me, and I can't get this. I'm constitutionally incapable of being honest with myself, and I'm a loser. And so I drank till I was like 43, I think, and yeah, 8 years, I guess. And I just, you know, again, I went to long-term rehab. I had a couple of alcoholic coma things where I was in the hospital for a long period of time with 0.43 alcohol. And one time, that, you know, just, well, kind of a funny story, I guess, is if it's funny now, it tells funny, but it didn't live funny. But so I'm in this, I started taking a lot of muscle relaxers and other things like that. So one day I fell out in my front yard. It's like, I don't know, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and it's 80 degrees, and I'm just passed out in my front yard, and I have this huge setback, and, you know, and everybody's driving by, and, like, you know, after 3 or 4 hours, my next door neighbors were like, something might be wrong with her. You know, she was laying in the front yard for several hours. And so they came and got me, and they take me, and I was like, I couldn't get the key in the door, so I decided to go to sleep. And they're like, what do you mean you couldn't get the key in the door? And I'm like, oh, have you ever had a bunch of muscle relaxers before? And they were like, no, we haven't. And I'm like, well, you're relaxing the muscles in your brain so much that you have no coordination. So I couldn't get, I didn't tell them that then, but I did when I made amends. I'm like, so I couldn't get the key in. So anyway, they get me in the house, and I'm like, so these neighbors, before I made amends, I had to really do them over. So what I did next was, alcohol wasn't being sold on Sunday, and so I had to go on a date with this guy I didn't really like. So instead of telling him I didn't want to go to the races with him, I decided to help myself into, he lived 2 doors down from me, and so I woke up one morning with him, and I was walking back home, and I thought, I'll go into the neighbor's house, and surely they have alcohol, and I have their key, because I didn't have any alcohol, and it was Sunday morning. So I go get their key, and I go into their house, and I know, it's insane, isn't it? This is like waking up thinking this is a good idea. So I go in their house, and the alarm goes off. I'm like, shit, they didn't have an alarm last time. I'm like, holy cow. I'm like, no, what am I going to do? And so I was like, quickly, you got to get the vodka. That's the most important thing. So I get the vodka, find a tumbler, pour this big old Grey Goose. I'm like, couldn't they have something cheaper? So I pour a Grey Goose in this tall thing, and I'm, you know, put the thing back, and I run out, and I get to my house, the phone's ringing. Hello? And they're like, we have an alarm going off, and you're the neighbor that would let us know whether or not there's any activity going on next door. And I'm like, oh, no, it's fine. I just walked by there. I must have set it off myself. I'm sorry. And they're like, you sure? I'm like, yeah, so I hang up. So then the neighbors call, and they go, do you know why our alarm's going off? I'm like, no idea, but I'll go check just to be sure. And so meanwhile, little did I know that that little alarm system they put in had cameras. So when they got home, they knew I was lying and that I stole their vodka. Of course, I didn't know that until the boyfriend I was sleeping with next door, they told him, and so he had to tell me, so I had to go back. It was utterly humiliating. But I never made it to the races because I drank so much. My brother found me, and I had to go in an ambulance to the hospital, and I was in an alcoholic overdose until like 11 o'clock at night, where my mother had to come again. So you see how this powerlessness is, and I couldn't do anything about it. And boy, I wanted to be sober, but I wasn't willing to do the things that an alcoholic like me has to do if they want to stay sober. You know, I know that some people can come in and get sober and get their lives back, and they can go out and live a normal life, and they can never come back to AA. I can't do that, and I don't choose to do that. I think that if everybody did that, Alcoholics Anonymous wouldn't be around today because there would be nobody here for the newcomer. So thank God I'm one that can't do that. I will always be here. There's nothing more important in my life than service work and Alcoholics Anonymous, because I am that same person that will drink again. After 8 years I did it, and it took me 6 to 8 years more to get sober. So finally it was 2009, and I had come out of a 4-month treatment program and drank yet again, and everybody was like, what is it going to take? And I ended up seeing this woman at this meeting. I went to that Oglethorpe meeting. I forget what it's called, but I went over there because I didn't know anybody there, and I was like, I'm just going to go there. And I heard this girl talk. She had short blonde hair, and I was like, dang, you know, she's all business, and everything she said made sense. And she was talking about how she cared about what people thought, but she couldn't care about that because she needed to care. You know, she needed to do what she needed to do to stay sober, and she had a bad alcohol problem. And I left and didn't think much of it. I probably drank. And then I went to another meeting, like, within 2 days, and that same girl was there. And I'm like, this is bizarre. I'm like, the same girl was there. And this time she was, like, either running the meeting or chairing the meeting. And I said, that is definitely that same girl. I thought, a little bit odd. And then a friend of mine said, hey, let's go over to Peachburg for a meeting. She probably won't check me in. But I said, okay. So I went on a Tuesday night, and this girl was at that meeting. I thought, you know, and I've always believed in God, so I thought, this is kind of like a God thing. I mean, this is weird. So I went over to her, and I asked her, you know, told her I'd seen her the other two nights, and I was babbling, and her name is Kathy, and she's still my sponsor today. And she said to me, do you need a sponsor? And I was like, well, yeah, I guess, really. I was sober 8 years before, and I never had one. And she goes, how long did you say you've been out there? And I'm like, about 8 years. She's like, you need a sponsor. She's like, I'll be your sponsor. And I'm like, okay, well, what do I have to do? And so she said, well, you know, you need to find a home group. And I'm like, oh, dear God, I never did all this stuff before. I just came in, and I got to be seen at Nava, and I got to be seen at Biscayne. It was all fun. I didn't have to join and do service. And she said, well, you know, we just opened up a home group, and you could come there if you want to, but I don't care. You don't have to join that, but you got to join one. And I'm like, where is it? And she told me where it was, and it was about a half a mile from my house. And I thought, oh, Lord. And then she said, so I thought, oh, you're probably married with kids. Y'all probably meet during the day, don't you? She goes, no, we meet at night. And I go, I have a job. She goes, no, we meet at night. She goes, what are you doing on Thursdays and Saturdays? And I'm like, she goes, drinking? And I'm like, no, I'm not. I was like, yeah, probably. She's like, why don't you come and see if you like it? So anyway, she said, we'll meet once a week, go through the book. You got to call other girls. She didn't tell me all that. I think she just said, we got to go through the book, and you got to find a home group and get a service position. So I came, I went to there, and I immediately felt like I didn't fit in, but I did it because I was bound and determined. I was like, I've got to do something different. And so I respected her, so I met her once a week, and we went page by page through the book. And that's still what I do with every single sponsee, starting at the, you know, the appendices, the, you know, forewords, whatever, all that. And and I didn't know, I was amazed at how little I knew about the book. And I'd been in here 8 years. It was almost embarrassing. I mean, it was embarrassing. It was ridiculous, really. I had no idea. And I think that unless you go page by page and have someone that's very versed in that explain to you what it is, it does not come alive for you. It does not make sense to you. And it certainly did not apply to me. I found all the differences. But as I go through it, I've been through it now, gosh, probably 100 times, because my home group does it every Thursday night. We just go round and round and round. And, you know, you get so many sponsees, and you go through the first 3 or 4 chapters, and then they disappear. So you got to do it again and again and again and again. And that's exactly what I need. And so I got sober. I joined the home group. I got a service position. I've held, you know, several in the group. I try to do, you know, anything like, you know, getting there earlier. I'm a greeter, I'm a usher, I'm a, you know, I collect the money, I help out any way that I can just to be a service. I sponsor, you know, started for a while. I didn't sponsor people. I thought nobody wants what I have, and you know, I'm not going to be good at that. And then, you know, my sponsor, you know, directed me to start sharing and doing things like this, and that people could relate to what you said, and that they could relate to your experience. They would ask you, because I thought you had to have important stuff memorized in the book. She's like, no, it's about your experience. She's like, just share what you went through. People will ask you, I promise. And so, you know, I started doing that, and life got really good. I met a man in my home group, and we got married, and we had a wonderful marriage. We traveled, and we had tons of fun, and we did, we had a very good life. We were able to seriously go to, you know, many, many different countries and do things that I never thought I'd be able to do, because I was the girl that I couldn't get out of Atlanta Airport. You know, I would be the one that missed the plane at the bar, someone saying, you got to move along, and then understand that I missed my flight. So I couldn't even drive. I didn't even have a license to drive. I could not travel. And so I got to do all these wonderful things in sobriety. And then I started dealing with hardships. And because I developed a relationship, you know, I got on my knees, you know, from the very beginning and asked God to, you know, keep me sober today. And I thanked him at night. And I remember, you know, I always had a good habitual prayerful life with gratitude and thankfulness. I was always that girl that was, thank you for this, because I recognize I've been tremendously blessed in my life. And so I was really good with that for the first 6, 7, 8 years, just constantly thanking God for my blessings. Maybe year 3 or 4, my brother died suddenly of a heart attack. That was very hard to get through. We were super close. He was one of us. And, you know, he lived with my mother, and that was very hard for my mother, who found him. So I thought, I'm never going to be able to get through this. And I remember my sponsor said, I said, I can't do this. There's no way I can do this. And she's like, you'll get through it. And I remember I wanted to take some Xanax or something for the funeral. And I remember it was one of the first times I called my sponsor and told him the truth. And she said, let me think for a second. And she goes, actually, you sound kind of fine. She goes, you sound fine to me. She goes, why don't you just go to the funeral? Be there for your mother. And I was like, bitch. She's like, I need Xanax to deal with my brother. And she was like, no, I think you're fine. And I realized that later I was fine. I didn't need anything. I was just trying to find another reason, like I always did. So we got through that. Within a year, my dad died, and maybe a year and a half, and I was my sole caretaker for my father, and financially, spiritually, friendship-wise, he had nobody, because when my mom finally divorced him after 34 years of marriage, he chose alcohol over her. He was even drinking in the independent living, and then, you know, and of course, he got sober for a while, and then he drank again, and then I told him I got angry when I found alcohol in the independent living, which was a very funny story that I don't have time for. But, you know, me and my friend went over there and found him. And, I'll tell you anyway, I guess I do have time for it. So we went over there one night, and my friend Barbara, who's in this program, is a great friend of mine. We were walking one day, I swear, out of the blue, and she said, hey, she said, Katie, she goes, look, if you ever need help with your dad, she goes, man, just give me a ring. She's a nurse. She's like, I'll be glad to help. I swear to God, I told this story while she's there. I go in the house, and they call me at the place, and they said, your dad has crapped all over himself and all over the floor, and he's been drinking, and we're independent living, so we don't take care of that. But you're going to need to come up here and do that. You know who I called? Barbara. I said, hey, Barb. So remember how you said you'd help me? I said, my dad needs some help. Can I come pick you up? She goes, yeah, what's going on? I'll tell you after I get you in the car. So I got her in the car. We get about halfway there. I tell her what happened. She goes, you could have told me ahead of time, so I could have brought my nurse glove. So we go in there, and I had no idea that my dad had started drinking at this time. Actually, they didn't say he'd been drinking. They just said he crapped himself. But I walk in there, and I'm all, you know, compassionate. We're trying to help him. He's sliding down the wall. It was like a pig pen. It was awful. And I was about to throw up. And Barbara's like, you know what? You're just loud. You're just causing chaos. She's like, just get out of here, and I'll deal with this. So I look toward the door, and Dad has gotten a 12-pack that he has somehow brought in his walker from the damn store to start drinking again. And by this time, I was financially supporting him. So I'm like, I was so pissed off. I was like, you will not drink on my dime. Because I was like, especially if I was going to have to come clean up shit all the time. It was a bad situation. But, you know, people in AA will do that for you, or nobody else will do that stuff for you. So, but my dad was like my best friend, man. I love that man. He was brilliant. He was funny. And, you know, I was just like him. I was powerless. And you know what? From the time I called my sponsor, another great thing she said, she goes, of course these, miserable, discontented, and irritable. She goes, he doesn't have a program. He's an alcoholic. And I'm like, God, you know, I mean, couldn't you cut me some slack and be like, I understand how hard it is to deal with this man? And she's like, no. She's like, unless you want to bring him an AA meeting, she goes, you need to treat him. He's a spiritually sick person like all these other people you help. And I'm like, oh, God. But, you know, most of the time I was good. I'm just kind of telling you about the bad stuff. But when my dad died, man, I had to make that decision because he couldn't swallow, and it was extremely hard. And I mean, I would start crying right now if I had to tell you, because we were just so close. I mean, he lasted so long after a stroke and in this thing, and he lasted another 10 years and got better, and he was just like the bionic man. And anyway, I had to make that very difficult decision in sobriety, and he died. And I remember, again, saying, I can't do this by myself. And my sponsor said, you're not. You got God. And again, I was just like, oh, God, yeah, I just can't go through this. And so got through that. Things got good again. I was very grateful and started learning that you can get through things in sobriety, you know, with God and with people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Nobody comes to your rescue except for maybe the church. If you're a church member for a couple of decades, they might come hound on you like AA does. But I'm telling you, AA shows up like nobody's business. I mean, it is, I can't tell you countless times I've set up meal rotations and service for people that's had surgeries. And I've had two this year, and, you know, the people in AA were just amazing, doing everything for me. I mean, they came, Connie came, brought me a meal, cooked it at my house. Everybody, just one after the next, shows up, what can I do, what can I do? Nobody does that like AA. So thank God I'm a member of this place. But, you know, life got really, really good, and we had the pandemic, and and I tell these things because to say that you don't get sober and your life is perfect for the rest of your life, it's just a hell of a lot better than when you were drinking and using, because you have, you know, you have a program, you have a way to get through things, you don't feel like garbage every single morning, and you're not hurting people. And I mean, I have a peaceful way of living right now that's amazing. I mean, my life is so, so good. And so God knows that I'm very thick-headed and don't get things. And so I started thinking, I don't know that I started thinking I'm doing this again all by myself, but I started being like, you know, I'm just so grateful for everything in my life. And then, like, all of a sudden, maybe, I don't know, a year and 2 months ago, my husband says, hey, I don't think I want to be married anymore. And I'm like, now I'm going to get crying. And I'm like, what are you talking about? I'm like, we have a great marriage. We laugh, we travel, we have fun, we're in AA. He says, I just don't think I want to be married anymore. I said, I'm hurting you, and I don't want to hurt you. So he moves out, and I don't tell anybody. And I'm thinking, oh, God, this is going to be, oh, I can tell my sponsor and three or four of my besties. But I cannot tell my mom, because my mom's just like in love with my husband. And so she's just like, you know, I'm like not going to tell her. So then he comes back January of this year and then decides he's not happy again. So he says he wants to leave again. So I was just like, you know, I can't do this. I can't live in this indecisiveness. So I was like, so you don't want to be married anymore? He's like, no, I don't think so. So I'm like, I'm filing. So I filed for divorce, got divorced within like a month and a half. And then from April this year until about, I don't know when, but even all last year, because he was gone for 7 months, I was just like, you know, God, how am I going to get through this? You know, this is just horrible. And I just kept praying every day, the prayers that, you know, my sponsor told me to pray. It was things like, you know, God, help me accept that this is your will for me, and convince me that I wouldn't have it any other way, even if I could. And I was just like, there's no way that I'm going to get convinced me I wouldn't have it any other way, even if I could. I'm like, you know, don't you see we're perfect for each other and we should be married? And, you know, I kept praying it. And I'm telling you, within like weeks, I had peace. I was just like, you know what? I'm going to be fine, just like I was through everything else. And I started being, you know, I did the acceptance pamphlet all the time. All these sponsees, I got many more sponsees. I started going through the book. My life just became so abundantly clear to me that I was going to be totally fine. I mean, I started loving being by myself, actually. And I was like, then I started seeing the truth about things. And I'm like, wow, the truth is that there was a lot of this negative energy in the house, and that I really wasn't that happy, and that if that was going to be the way marriage is, I don't want to be like that between now and dead. You know, I used to always say, between now and dead, is this what you want out of your life? And I would just convince myself, because I thought, better for worse, you stay married, it wasn't that bad, you know, it wasn't cheating or anything. So, but he wasn't a happy person, and he was suffering, and he didn't want to make me miserable, so I had to take him at his you know, and His Word. And so, anyway, I just, my life got so good so quickly. And I was like, thank you, God, for showing me that I am okay by myself as long as I have Alcoholics Anonymous. Of course, you know, I have so many other blessings. I'm still at this job that is amazing and that I don't have to work very hard to get a lot of rewards. And so, you know, I just had to look at all the good in my life. So then about, I don't know, maybe 5 months ago or something like that. This is how God shows up for you if you just trust Him and if you have faith. So then about 5 months ago, this guy that I had never seen in my life, now I've been living in my house for 25 years. He's been living, this guy, my neighbor, has been living in his house for 13 years, okay? So I have not crossed paths with this man who's been living around the corner from me for 13 years. I'm an avid walker. Walk miles and miles and miles. So does he. Never seen the guy. All of a sudden, I start seeing him constantly. Started talking, time after time, talking. Finally, he goes, hey, you want to go to dinner? We go to dinner. We go out to, he orders a drink, and he says, hey, he goes, I'm just going to have Perrier. What do you want? And I go, I'll have the same. And he goes, looks at me, he goes, oh, I don't drink. And I go, me either. And he goes, you a friend of Bill? And I go, yeah, are you? And he goes, yeah. And I'm like, you got to be kidding me. He goes, I got 6 years. How long do you have? And I was like, I have 12. And he's like, wow. He's like, this is crazy. And I'm like, yeah. And so then a little more comes on. I go, where are you from? He goes, I'm from Denham Springs, Baton Rouge. I said, you're kidding me. My ex-husband's from Denham Springs, Baton Rouge. I don't know anybody from Denham Springs, Baton Rouge, ever. And this guy's from there. I'm like, this is insane. And so I said, wow. And he said, yeah, I cook jambalaya, and I'm a country boy. And I'm like, oh, my God. I was like, this is so strange. Come to find out, he's born 5 days before me. And it just on and on. It goes to my dentist, goes to my hygienist. I'm like, this is the strangest thing ever. I've never seen the guy. Then within a couple weeks, I see him at Publix, everywhere I go. Insane. So, you know, I just started trusting God and saying, you know, I'm just having fun. And now we've been going out for about 4 or 5 months, and things are going well. And he's, you know, it's amazing. And as God would have it, now my husband wants me back, so it's not too bad. He actually finally decided to call and tell me that. And I said, you know, of course I told my close friends, and they're like, well, duh, we could have told you that was going to happen. But I told them, I said, you got to do a lot of things. You got to get well. You got to get, you know, you got to get spiritually well, and you got to do some things. And I've got to see where this goes, because I can't believe in God's will and then immediately take my will back and try to manage it and say, this guy who came in and showed me that I can be loved and I can be treated well and I can be the kitty cat's meow again doesn't just get tossed to the wayside because now you want back in. And I told him all that, you know, in an hour-long conversation. And he was like, I was like, hello, are you still there? And he was like, yeah, I'm here. He's like, I just don't know what to say. And you know, and we had this long conversation. And he said, well, you know, I'm just going to do everything that I need to do. And if we're meant to be together, then, you know, you'll be there when I'm better and I'll be whatever. And so, you know, we still talk every day. And I'm transparent with the other guy. And he's like, that's fine. I understand it. And you know, I'm still Trey's person, and I want the best for him. I love him so much, you know. But it's just, you know, you just don't know what life's going to throw at you, and you got to just be, you know, you got to do these kind of things each day. Show up, ask God to help you and direct your thoughts and keep you sober so that you can, you know, continue to make the decisions that, you know, He would have you make. And although I have tears in my eyes, my life is fantastic. It's really, really good, and I'm just so blessed. And I'm so grateful I got to do this tonight. Thank you. And I'm just a very emotional person, but, you know, it's good to be transparent because I know that I've connected with a few of y'all and hopefully helped some of y'all tonight to know that if you are powerless over alcohol and you don't, you're sick of living this way of life, you know, this program will work for you and nothing else will. And I'm a testament to that. And I can tell you that, you know, I have it as bad as you can get it. And I no longer have a craving to use, and I have peace and serenity in my life that I never had when I was drinking and using. Absolutely never had. And all I did when I drank was I stressed out on how I could get more, when I was going to be able to drink again, how I was going to get away with it where nobody was going to, you know, I wasn't going to hurt anybody. And I just was, you know, just chasing that tail all the time like a rat in a cage. And I don't have that now. Peace of mind, and I have gratitude, and I have sobriety, and I have a way of life, and I have a God, and my life is fantastic today. And so thank you for letting me sit down and share tonight. I appreciate it. I will. Thank you. Thank you, Katie. That was beautiful and raw. I like it.
on this page, the emptiness of my heart, this lost and lonely feeling wants to tear me apart. I take off my coat, but I can't sit down, no. I'm looking at myself from the other side of town. I'm just trying to be somebody like me. Maybe someday I'll run into myself. I'm just trying to be somebody like me. I know you ain't no love, nobody else. I tear off another page and I throw it away. While I wait for nothing to happen day after day, take the shirt off my back, take the shoes off my feet, kind of feels invisible down underneath. I'm just trying to be somebody like me. Maybe someday I'll run into myself. Against the white noise coming from my telephone. Had to make my choice. Had to take it off the hook. Somebody's tapping at my window, but I just don't wanna look.